Welcome to Hub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This week is episode 20, John Hancock's Private Army. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. And this week, we're going to take a look at the Independent Company of Cadets, an elite militia unit that was commanded by Patriot leader John Hancock in 1774. We'll learn the unique history of the unit, see how the incoming military governor of Massachusetts dismissed Hancock on the eve of revolution, and find out how their legacy continues into the present day. But first, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is March 13th, and that's the date in 1639 when the college at Newtown was renamed for a donor. Newtown is what we called Cambridge back in those days, and in 1636, the Great and General Court of Massachusetts Bay had set aside the lofty sum of £400 to start a school or college. A year later, they chose the site of the school in Newtown, and the year after that, the legislature renamed the town Cambridge, in honor of the famous college town in Old England. That year, a Puritan minister and early settler of Charlestown passed away, likely of tuberculosis. He had been educated at Emmanuel College in the original Cambridge, staying at his studies for about 6 years before marrying and emigrating to the New World. After his long stay at Emmanuel, he had come to Charlestown with a library of over 400 books, and in his will, he left these and half of the value of his estate to the college in the New Cambridge. In gratitude for his gift, the Great and General Court renamed the college after its benefactor, John Harvard.
March 14, 1887 was a sunny Monday morning in Boston. In Dedham, a locomotive was hitched up to 9 open-platformed cars, all of which were finished in fancy red varnish. The engineer that morning was a 31-year veteran of the Dedham Branch Railroad, and he made the run from Dedham to Boston almost every day. At 7 a.m. sharp, the train pulled out of Dedham, stopping at Spring Street, West Roxbury, Highland, and Central. By the time they pulled out of Roslindale Station, they were carrying well over 200 passengers. About a half mile outside Forest Hills, the tracks crossed a small bridge known as Bussy Bridge over South Street. As the train crossed over, the bridge collapsed under its weight. A surviving passenger described what he saw to the Boston Globe. "I was sitting in the rear seat of the third car. The first thing I noticed was the derailment of the front end of the car. This was a third of the way across the bridge. I was facing the window, talking to a young lady. In less than 6 seconds, the rear end of the car seemed to sink, and the heads of the passengers in the front appeared at least 6 feet higher than our own. Then came a violent shock that tore away the flooring. The front platform of the car was carried forward and struck the abutment. The rear end of the car also struck the abutment with great force. The fourth through ninth cars crashed to the street below, smashed to pieces. 37 people were killed, and many more were seriously injured. The case made national news due to the graphic nature of the injuries, but also because it quickly came out that the accident had been utterly preventable. The bridge had been rebuilt from a wood structure to an iron truss by contractors who had no understanding of structural ironwork, out of iron beams, that were made with no quality control. Many of the trusses met at odd angles, and some of the connectors couldn't be accessed for inspection. Some of them had rusted completely through, and some were dangerously weakened. By the time the 7 a.m. to Boston got there that day, the bridge simply gave way. We'll have a link to a special report on the accident by the Massachusetts Board of Railroad Commissioners in this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/020. After the disaster, railroad bridges in Massachusetts were ordered to be inspected by a qualified engineer every 2 years, and today, Bussy Bridge is a sturdy granite arch.
Wednesday is March 15th, and on March 15th, 1921, a 40-page booklet was published called South End House, A Visit, by Alan D. Albert, student of cities. South End House was a settlement house, a type of multi-service, place-based agency that was popularized in the U.S. by Jane Addams of Chicago's Hull House. South End House was founded in 1892 as Andover House on Roland Street. By the time Albert visited, they had expanded to 6 different locations in the South End, offering housing for the indigent, education, arts instruction, health care for women and children, youth programs, and many more services. Today, the agency is known as United South End Settlements, and they are celebrating their 125th anniversary. We'll have a link to the book and the USCS 125 website in the show notes this week at hubhistory.com/020.
In more recent history, Boston set a new record on March 16, 2015. We got an additional 2.9 inches of snow that day, which brought the seasonal total to 108.6 inches, making the winter of 2015 the snowiest since Boston started keeping records.
Friday is March 17th, which we celebrate as Evacuation Day. On that date in 1776, the British troops who had occupied Boston for almost a decade and who had been besieged by the surrounding Patriots for almost a year left the city behind. After the Continentals had occupied the strategic high ground of Dorchester Heights 2 weeks before, the evacuation seemed inevitable. The British troops were just waiting on favorable winds to carry them out of Boston Harbor. The night before, Abigail Adams wrote in a letter to John, "There has been some movement amongst the ministerial troops, as if they meant to evacuate the town of Boston. Between 70 and 80 vessels of various sizes are gone down and lay in a row in fair sight of this place, all of which appear to be loaded, and by what can be collected from our observations and from deserters, that they have been plundering the town. I have been very faithless with regard to their quitting Boston, and know not how to account for it. Nor am I yet satisfied that they will leave it, though it seems to be the prevailing opinion of most people."
On the morning of the 17th, the British boarded their ships and began to sail away. John Rowe noted the event in his diary that day, saying, "This morning, the troops evacuated the town and went on board the transports at and about Long Wharf. They sailed and got most part of them into King Road. About noon, General Putnam and some troops came into town to the great joy of the inhabitants that remained behind." George Washington also wrote several letters to officials that day, including this one to the governor of Rhode Island. "I have the pleasure to inform you that this morning the ministerial troops evacuated the town of Boston without destroying it, and that we are now in its full possession. Upon which event I beg leave to congratulate you, and sincerely wish that our opposition and resistance in every quarter may be crowned with the success they have been here." Things didn't look so cheerful from the perspective of a British soldier on board one of those transports, who wrote, "According to my promise, I proceed to give a brief account of our retreat, which was made this morning between the hours of 2 and 8. The Dragoons are under orders to sail tomorrow for Halifax, a cursed, cold, wintry place, even yet. Nothing to eat, less to drink. Bad times, my dear friend."
The morning after the British departure, Abigail Adams updated her letter with her joy and astonishment at the turn of events. "A fine, quiet night. No alarms, no cannon. The more I think of our enemies quitting Boston, the more amazed I am that they should leave such a harbor, such fortifications, such entrenchments, and that we should be in peaceable possession of a town which we expected would cost us a river of blood without one drop shed. Surely it is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Every foot of ground which they obtain now, they must fight for, and may they purchase it at a Bunker Hill price." In the show notes this week, we'll include pictures of the huge solid gold medal that Congress presented Washington with a few years later to thank him for liberating Boston. On one side is a bust of Washington, and on the other is a picture of him at Dorchester Heights with the motto, "Hostibus primo fugatus," or, "For the first time, the enemy is put to flight." You can find those at hubhistory.com/020.
Before dawn on March 18, 1990, guards at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in the Fenway heard a knock at the door. Two men dressed in Boston police uniforms were outside, claiming that they were responding to a report of a disturbance on the premises. Once inside, they subdued and tied up the guards. They then stole 13 works of art, including paintings by Degas, Rembrandt, Vermeer, and Manet. In 2015, there was a flurry of activity, with the FBI announcing that they were investigating new leads and appealing to the public for relevant information. As recently as May 2016, they searched the home of an alleged mobster in Connecticut in connection with this case. However, the crime remains unsolved, and the FBI continue to investigate.
Finally, Sunday is March 19th. On March 19th, 1850, Boston's celebrity trial of the 19th century began. Professor John White Webster of Harvard Medical School stood accused of murdering George Parkman, a wealthy physician and landlord to whom Webster had owed money. Parkman had tried to collect the debt, and a few days before Thanksgiving, 1849, Webster proposed that the two meet at the medical college. Parkman was never seen alive again. Parts of his body were discovered in a privy vault under Webster's lab in the medical college. Bone fragments, including the jawbone and teeth, were found in a furnace in the lab, and a burned and mangled torso was found in a trunk belonging to Webster. Eventually, the body was identified by the jawbone. A dentist had made a mold in order to fashion a prosthetic, and the mold fit perfectly with the teeth found in the furnace. The idea of an upper-class Boston Brahmin being tried for murder was so foreign that the courtroom was packed. The police were able to sell tickets to view the trial, and newspaper special editions carried each day's proceedings. In the end, Webster was convicted and sentenced to hang. We'll tell the full story of the Parkman murder and the remarkable Webster trial in a future episode. And now, let's turn to our main topic, John Hancock's private army.
On May 17, 1774, John Hancock and a small militia unit stood in formation on Boston's Long Wharf, awaiting a ship from England. On board the ship was the new Royal Governor of Massachusetts, General Thomas Gage. After the Boston Tea Party the previous December, Parliament had instituted a series of punitive measures against Boston, collectively known as the Intolerable Acts. Governor Thomas Hutchinson was seen as too weak and unpopular to enforce the crackdown, so he was recalled, and General Gage was sent in his place. Gage started out as a fairly popular figure in America, though the bloom was quickly off the rose here in Boston. He had served with distinction in the French and Indian War, including in the disastrous Battle of the Monongahela, where he and young George Washington became friends after organizing the British retreat. After the war, he was appointed as Commander-in-Chief of North America in 1763 and moved to New York City. In this position, he had sweeping civil authority across British North America, as well as unlimited military power. After the Stamp Act riots of 1765, he began to see Boston as the seat of colonial unrest, saying, "America is a mere bully from one end to the other, and the Bostonians by far the greatest bullies." As tempers rose, Gage ordered two regiments of royal troops to occupy Boston in 1768, ratcheting up the tensions that would lead to the Boston Massacre in 1770. Gage returned to England in 1773, after a decade as Commander-in-Chief of North America. Just a year later, in May of 1774, he was returning as the military governor of Massachusetts, charged with enforcing the Intolerable Acts and tamping down the rebellious, democratic streak that popular leaders in Boston were encouraging. Gage came to see popular government, as embodied by the New England town meeting, as a threat to crown rule, saying, "Democracy is too prevalent in America." So how did John Hancock, one of the popular Democratic leaders who was a leading critic of the Intolerable Acts, come to meet General Gage at the head of an armed militia unit? In 1772, Hancock had been elected colonel of the Independent Company of Cadets, which had, since 1728, acted as personal bodyguards to the governor of Massachusetts. Hancock took a lot of pride in his unit, drilling them on the manual of arms at dawn every Wednesday on Boston Common. He used his personal fortune to retain musicians to play the fife and drums for their parades. And he made sure that they were all decked out in proper uniforms. A scarlet coat with buff lapels and undercloth, white gaiters with black bottoms, and a cocked beaver hat with a large cockade secured by a golden tie to a gilt button.
John Hancock and the Independent Company of Cadets felt that their loyalties lay not with General Gage, but with Massachusetts tradition and the office of the governor. As early as 1634, six men were appointed to attend to the governor at each meeting of the general court, armed with swords and halberds, which are medieval weapons that look like an axe on a long pole. The unit began in 1728 as a guard to Governor William Burnett. A newspaper from July of that year reports, "About 6 o'clock, the company of young gentlemen cadets in their order and gaiety waited upon His Excellency, and escorted him to the house of the Honorable Elisha Cook, Esquire. The company fired 3 volleys and exercised their arms with their vaunted beauty and exactness before they were dismissed." Benjamin Pollard, a member of the Ancient and Honorable Artillery Company and former Suffolk County Sheriff, founded the unit, believing that such a ceremonial unit was needed in the colony. All of the members of the company were volunteers, who could afford to take the time to drill and the money to furnish themselves with weapons and uniforms. They had no formal military status, and the unit folded within a few years. Benjamin Pollard refused to give up on his dream, and he eventually prevailed on Governor William Shirley to charter the Independent Company of Cadets, a formal provincial military unit consisting of 64 men. In October of 1741, the governor would appoint commissioned officers to command the unit. The first was Benjamin Pollard, who was commissioned captain of the cadets, but also colonel in the Massachusetts militia by Governor Shirley. This tradition of dual rank would continue until 1874, and was considered a privilege for the officers who commanded the governor's bodyguard. The officers and men served for prestige, as well as to gain valuable military experience that could be translated into an officer's appointment in the provincial militia. The company's first formal duties came in the fall of 1741, when they escorted Governor Shirley on a trip to the Rhode Island state line, which was being adjusted and required his oversight. Their constant training and ceremonial precision meant that the Independent Company of Cadets quickly became one of the most elite units in the province's militia. Over the next three decades, their duties would be similar, escorting the governor at parades and ceremonies, drilling, and undergoing an annual review during the parade celebrating the king's birthday.
John Hancock joined the cadets in 1766, during the gradual increase in hostility that followed the Stamp Act riots and repeal. During this period, the Company of Cadets continued their ceremonial duties to the office of the governor, but they also began to sympathize with the Patriot cause. In 1770, as clashes between the citizens of Boston and the occupying troops became more frequent, the cadets were sometimes called upon to stand guard at the Custom House, until that duty was taken over by British regulars. Customs commissioners were a very visible symbol of British authority and of the hated Intolerable Acts. In 1773, Governor Hutchinson hosted a party, and the cadets under Colonel Hancock were on hand to formally welcome the governor's guests. They stood in two ranks at present arms, and each carriage would pull up, then the guests would walk ceremoniously down the aisle between two rows of cadets. When one coach opened its door, the customs commissioners stepped out. Two of the cadets turned their muskets upside down and walked away. That night, Hancock called for a vote and had them both expelled from the company for unmilitary conduct. By this time, the sentiments of the cadets lay firmly with the Patriot cause. About half of the members of the company were also Sons of Liberty. When the Boston Tea Party occurred in December 1773, many of the cadets took part, including Lyndall Pitts, who was one of the leaders, and Moses Grant, who had been dismissed from the company after refusing to wait on the customs commissioners. After the unpopular Lieutenant Governor Andrew Oliver died in March 1774, his funeral parade was one of the last public appearances of the Company of Cadets before General Gage came to town. Oliver had been on the wrong side of public opinion in Boston since he publicly supported the Stamp Act in 1765. He was hanged in effigy, and a mob ransacked his house. He resigned, but his reputation never recovered. As Lieutenant Governor, some of his personal letters were published in 1773, which indicated that he was in favor of the hated Townsend Acts. When he died, many sources say that the Sons of Liberty celebrated, members of the legislature boycotted his funeral, and, quote, "marks of disrespect were also shown by the populace to the remains of a man whose memory, if he had died before this violent spirit was raised, would have been revered by all orders and degrees of men in the province." Despite all that, the cadets marched in his funeral parade, in order to provide him with the military honors due to him. A furious Samuel Adams confronted John Hancock and demanded to know why he would honor so notorious a Tory. Hancock replied that the cadets paid tribute to the office, not to the character of the man.
So that was the charged atmosphere that General Thomas Gage arrived to in May of 1774. He was met at Long Wharf by an honor guard of cadets led by John Hancock, but their relationship seems to have gotten off to a rocky start. The very next night, Gage hosted a formal dinner at Faneuil Hall, and Hancock declined to attend. Gage got an idea for the temperament of the town that night when he proposed a toast to the outgoing Governor Hutchinson and was met with a collective hiss from the assembled guests. It was traditional for a new royal governor to present the independent company of cadets with a new standard or unit flag. One side would bear the seal of the province and the arms of the cadets with the motto Monstrat Vium, or It Points the Way. On the other side, the governor would affix his coat of arms. Gaged carried on this tradition, presenting a new standard to the cadets soon after his arrival. Unfortunately, as one historian put it, Gage and Hancock were as flint and steel, and the contact soon produced sparks which helps to keep alight the train of discontent, leading to the impending explosion of the revolution. By summer, Gage had apparently come to the conclusion that having a fiery patriot leader as the commander of his personal bodyguard wasn't such a good idea. Hancock left town briefly in July to visit with family in Bridgewater. When he returned to Boston, there was a letter waiting from him from Gage's secretary, dated August 1st, 1774. In terse language, it said, "Sir, I am directed by His Excellency, the Captain General, to acquaint you that he has no further service for you as the captain of the Governor's Company of Cadets, and you are hereby dismissed from that command." John Hancock took the summary firing and the needlessly cavalier language as immense insult. He had invested a lot of time, money, and effort into the Company of Cadets, and he was rightly proud of their accomplishments. The cadets themselves were equally outraged. They had always retained the right, as was typical in New England militia units, of electing their own officers. With the dismissal of Hancock, they met on August 15th and drafted a letter to the governor. "May it please Your Excellency, it having been this day communicated to us, in a regular meeting, that Your Excellency has thought fit to displace the Honorable John Hancock, Esquire, from his command as the captain of the cadet company, they take the earliest opportunity to express their extreme regret at this removal of their first officer, and considering it the distinction with which they have hitherto been favored in the choice and continuation of their officers. They look upon this dismission as disbanding the corps. They have therefore judged proper to return Your Excellency the standard you presented to the company upon your taking of the chair of government, and at the same time take the liberty to inform Your Excellency that from the day of the removal of Colonel Hancock from his command, they no longer consider themselves as the governor's independent company of cadets. With their colors returned and their unit disbanded, the cadets returned their uniforms and instruments to Hancock for safekeeping, with a note that he should animate and conduct the cause of virtue and of freedom."
Hancock would not rest on his laurels, and spent the next several years conducting the cause of virtue and freedom. After Governor Gage dissolved the General Court, John Hancock was elected president of the Massachusetts Provincial Congress, the revolutionary shadow government that exercised power outside Boston and outside the reach of the British military. The Provincial Congress began stockpiling arms and supplies in Concord, and raising a militia. When Gage sent troops to seize these supplies in April of 1775, war broke out. Gage offered to pardon any rebels who would lay down their arms, except John Hancock and Sam Adams. Hancock went to Philadelphia to represent Massachusetts in the Second Continental Congress. That May, he was elected president of Congress, which is why his John Hancock appears first on the declaration they signed the following July. As noted in this week's historical anniversaries, the British evacuated Boston on March 17, 1776. That spring, the Company of Cadets was reorganized. In light of the ongoing war, their splendid red uniforms no longer seemed appropriate, so they adopted a black uniform coat trimmed with red facings. John Hancock, who was away serving in Congress, was elected as their honorary colonel, while Henry Jackson served as their commander. Several of the officers who'd been trained in the company went on to raise regiments in the Continental Army, while the cadets themselves continued as Massachusetts militia, and were mobilized several times. They guarded prisoners and captured ships, they garrisoned the fort at Dorchester Heights after the main body of the army moved on to the New York campaign, and they served briefly under their old commander when Major General John Hancock led the Massachusetts militia against the British forces in Rhode Island in the summer of 1778. After the Revolution, the unit reorganized again in 1786 with the primary objective of grooming officers for service in the regular military during wartime. while they also continued their ceremonial duties. They served in Shay's Rebellion, they provided the officer corps for the 2nd, 20th, and 24th Infantry Regiments in the Civil War, and they enlisted heavily in the 45th Mass Volunteer Infantry. During the Spanish-American War, they were activated to guard coastal artillery installations along the Massachusetts coast, and served during natural disasters in the state in the early 20th century. They converted to an engineering regiment in 1917, and served with the 26th Yankee Division in France during World War I, seeing heavy combat. They served as a police force during the 1919 Boston police strike, then converted to the 211th Artillery Regiment in the 20s. The unit was activated for World War II service, and elements of the Corps of Cadets saw action in both the European and Pacific theaters. Today, that legacy is carried on by the 211th Military Police Battalion, 1st Corps of Cadets. Their most recent combat was in Iraq in 2003. Have you ever walked past the corner of Arlington Street and Columbus Ave and looked up at the massive stone edifice of the Castle at Park Plaza? This magnificent structure is a relic from a period in the history of the Cadet Corps when they seemed as interested in musical theater as they were in training officers for the state militia. In 1876, the Veterans Association of the 1st Corps of Cadets was formed to raise funds to build a new armory for the cadets. The building was desired to store the unit's uniforms and instruments, as well as weapons, historical documents, and to host unit functions. Half the money was raised by a direct appeal to the public, while the other half was raised by a series of public performances by the cadets. Over the course of about 20 years, they put on 2 minstrel shows and 13 light operettas. These operetta performances were a huge success in the era of Gilbert and Sullivan, and they were only stopped because the commanding officers of the unit believed, probably rightly, that they were a distraction from the cadets' military work. They did raise enough money to construct an impressive armory. It was designed to be able to withstand a riot or communist insurrection, while providing a signal tower from which the cadets could communicate with officials at City Hall or the State House. Today, it's owned by the Boston Park Plaza Hotel and used as a banquet hall and conference center.
Guess what we have this week?
What's that?
Listener feedback. We got several listener comments on last week's show about two hermits in and around Boston. Giles Parker, superintendent of Boston Harbor Island's National Historic Site, reached out on Twitter to say that he had never heard last week's tale of a hermit living on a shipwreck on Spectacle Island, and that it sounded straight out of Fallout 4. If we can tell a story that the park superintendent doesn't know, we may be doing something right. Max Grinnell, a historian and professor who calls himself an urbanologist, learned about our hermit living in the woods of Hyde Park and commented that it's still ever so distant from the hub of the hub. Boston's official city archaeologist Joe Bagley chimed in and suggested a joint dig of the hermit's cabin with the DCR's archaeologist Ellen Berkland. If that ever comes to fruition, we'll let you know.
Okay. If anyone wants to find out more about the Independent Company of Cadets, check out our show notes this week at hubhistory.com/020. We'll have a great 1943 article on the company that was one of the main sources for this week, as well as the company's own official history, including the letters sent between Gage, the cadets, and Hancock during their showdown in 1774. We'll also have portraits of both Hancock and Gage by famed Boston artist John Singleton Copley, as well as a poem on their rift published by a Boston newspaper in 1774. You can also see a picture of the cadet armory and notes from a 1977 hearing that debated whether to designate it as a historic landmark. We'll also share a couple of links related to Tripod, a month-long effort to get more people acquainted with podcasts and podcasting. If you're convincing your friends to try a pod, why not start with ours? And if any of you Boston history fans will be at History Camp this weekend, be sure to stop by and say hello.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter and at facebook.com/hubhistory. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with the story of a deadly 1897 explosion on Tremont Street. It wasn't an act of war or terrorism, but a terrible accident.